Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we are working to record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, August 30th, 2019, is Gregory White. Thank you for joining us, Greg.
Well, thank you, Sue.
Before we begin, Greg, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career, at which facilities you worked, and the titles you held?
Sure. I started back in 1976 at SCI Rockview, and I worked there for 10 years as a corrections officer, sergeant, and lieutenant. And I left in October of 86 and took the position of Chief of Security, Fire and Safety at the Central Office for the Department. Worked there a little more than 3 years, or right around 3 years, actually. First of October, I was promoted and reassigned as Deputy of Operations at SCI Waymart, which was still at that time Farview State Hospital. And then I worked there until 93, at which time I was promoted and moved to SCI Pittsburgh as superintendent. Worked there for 3 years as superintendent, then moved to SCI Green as the deputy of facility management. SCI, after 2 years there, went to Greensburg as deputy of facility management and ended my career at opening SCI Pine Grove as deputy of facility management. I retired in 2001.
Okay, thank you. All right, so now let's talk about the Camp Hill Prison riot. Tell us what you remember about the riot. So where were you on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989?
Mm-hmm. I was at Waymart. We were planning to get it opened. We had a plan working with the Department of Public Welfare. And we were on the telephone. Chuck Zimmerman.
Uh-oh, are you there? I lost you. No. Greg? Greg?
Where?
I lost you.
Son of...
If you, just start over again where you were. I completely lost you after you said you were up there, that you had been working with the Department of Public Welfare.
Okay. Sure. Myself and Connor Blaine and Chuck Zimmerman were on the phone. We were at Waymart. We were on the phone with Bob Lorenz in central office, and Bob said, gee, I can't really talk right now. There's a Camp Hill's exploding. There's a riot going on. It's right in front of the, of course, his office looked out onto the compound of Camp Hill. He said, it's really, they're out of control. And we told him, Bob, what we're going to do is call all the other institutions so they know what's going on, and so that's what we did. We called everybody, told them what was going on, and then Chuck and I talked a minute. He said, hey, I'm a senior superintendent. You're still the chief of security. We're not doing anything up here that's important. Let's drive to Camp Hill. So we drove down to Camp Hill, went into a central office building and met with Deputy Doremus and Secretary Owens and just helped as we could around the office there.
Can I interrupt? So you're up at Waymart, and so obviously you were talking to central office initially. The riot started around 3 p.m. And so then you headed down. How long does that ride take? And what time do you think you got to central office that evening then?
Yeah, It was right about when the riot was started, so between 3 and 3:30, got some stuff together and just got in the car and left. It's about a 2.5 to 3 hour ride, depending on traffic. So it would have been 7 o'clock probably when we got there.
Okay, so things were pretty well underway by the time you got here.
Absolutely, yeah. It was really fully engulfed at that time.
So from a chief of security and safety, everything, what exactly were you doing for that first night when you were here at Central Office watching the riot take place out the windows?
One of the people came out and told us, they were a food service instructor, and they told us about hiding knives down in the storage area of the culinary area. And Keith Graham, who was the department's chief of food service, and myself and some other staff went down there and tried to find those knives. We were able to get into that building, even though there was a lot of activity all around me. The riots, it was still not under control at that time. So we went looking for those knives to make sure that we could find them and get them someplace where they wouldn't be found by inmates.
Inside the prison?
Yes.
Okay, wow. Because that really was right in the area where everything was happening.
Yeah, we were able to get in a basement door, basically, and we felt pretty secure in there. But there was a lot of activity all around, that's for sure.
Okay, so you secured those knives, and then what?
I went back to the DOC command post in the secretary's office, basically, and was there for a while. I went back to my office down the hall and did a few things, and Superintendent Friedman came over to the office, and there were some other people with him, and they had a discussion with Secretary Owens and Deputy DeRamus, and Freeman wanted to go back inside. By this time, things were getting under control. It was getting later at night, maybe 11 o'clock or 10:30, and so they said, yeah, go ahead, Superintendent, and I said, Superintendent.
Oh, no. I lost you again.
Okay. You there?
Okay. Yeah, so start with, they said, okay, Superintendent, and then go from there.
I said, Superintendent, it'd be inappropriate for you to go in there by yourself. I'll go with you. So I walked in, the two of us walked through the institution as much as we could at that time. There was still some stuff going on, and a lot of state police and COs and stuff like that. A lot of activity yet, and we were around to try to assess some of the damage from the outside. And Ken Chubb met with us, and then about midnight, I guess it was, we came back out.
And lost you after that. So what happened after midnight?
After midnight, sort of things were semi under control, and they felt that they had things contained. And when we were walking up, in fact, one of the pictures I saw was us walking up that one main road.
Mm-hmm.
It was just surrounding state police and corrections officers and some other local police. And the firefighters just lining that road. It was surreal.
Right. So tell me about the status of the facilities. Did they have the inmates locked in cells? And obviously the cells were kind of damaged, so they were just kind of stuffing inmates where they could, and then they fed them. Was there ever a search of the facility done at that point?
We were getting just bits and pieces of information and trying to determine you know, housing unit by housing unit, what the status was. At this time, the modular units didn't seem to be affected. But it was just trying to piece together what the status of everything was. I know they never got a clear count. They were trying to determine who was where, and as you said, several inmates in the same cell just to get them secured and that kind of stuff. It was very difficult to get verifiable information as to exactly what the status was, housing unit by housing.
A lot of people that I've talked to and interviewed for this project seem to use the same word to describe the situation, and it was chaos. Would you agree with that?
But at this time it was almost more organized chaos. It seemed like the inmates themselves were under control at this time. It was just a matter of trying to figure out how where the damage was in the institution and what tomorrow was going to bring.
Okay, you went home then?
Yeah, I got home about 2 o'clock in the morning. Got up the next morning, came into central office and went to my office in chief of security office, and was trying to. I didn't get much clear direction as to what we should be doing at that time. They're leaving most of that up to the institution itself. And I really never did get much direction that day as to what the status was or what was things or what I should be doing, frankly. About 5:30, I left the office, went to Galifti's, met my wife and two daughters. We had some pizza, and next thing you know, we're coming out about 7 o'clock, and a fire truck goes by, and I said, if that fire truck takes the next left, that's bad. And, of course, it did, and so we followed it and got as toward the institution to where I could pull in near the abattoir or somewhere like that, turn around.
Okay.
And just told them to go home, and I ran up the road to go back to my office to start calling people.
And so...
it was burning, it was bad, it was a real chaotic scene then. I know I'm running up the road and this police car comes flying up and stops and looks at me and says, what should I be doing? I said, how about controlling traffic on the road? He says, great idea.
Uh-huh.
From there it went downhill.
And they did actually end up putting roadblocks at the end of Lisburn Road and then at Lisburn and Slate Hill to control traffic. Like, you had to use your ID to get through.
Yeah, so I'm running up the road, and of course I have my ID on me, and it goes flipping out into the middle of the road.
Oh no!
And the traffic's coming, and I made a run, scoop, and picked it up. Or I'd have been probably, I'd have had to go by facial recognition, which wasn't very much with the police of the area there. But then I was running up the road, going back to my office, and at that point I heard a lot of gunfire. So I'm running by Camp Hill's front gate, and I mean, I heard a lot of gunfire. I said, oh my goodness, this is beyond my wildest beliefs. Went back to my office, and I started calling people in. I can remember calling people, and they would not believe me. They said, it's not possible that Camp Hill's on fire again. And started calling in some of the people from central office, and I heard some people in the hallway. I come out, it's Secretary Owens and Deputy Doremus again, and they were surprised to see me. I told them what I had already done, And Secretary Owen said, go to Camp Hill's command post and be our eyes and ears there and keep us informed. So I went to the Camp Hill administration building, met up with the people at the command post, and spent the rest of the night there. It didn't take long for it to really get just totally out of control. It was between the state police and the local police and the fire departments and everything. It was a pretty amazing scene, just something you'd never see again.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right. And from the command post, which was, like you said, in the superintendent's office in the administration building for the prison, the way the prison front gate was at the time, you had a pretty good view into the institution and could see what was going on, especially in the group one area where the modulars were.
Yes. And there was a lot of fire there. It was a very, a scene that you wouldn't think the modular had that much stuff to burn, but they certainly did. And then as we started calling in people from other institutions, the emergency teams, as they called them then, I would meet with them at the front gate, talk to them, tell them where we thought they should go. We just didn't have much information as to what was going on inside there, except we knew there were a lot of inmates on the one field that didn't want to be involved, but they sort of needed to be protected and also guarded at the same time. So we sent a lot of folks that direction. Sometime during the night, we started talking about equipment, and it was clear that we did not have the hardware, handcuffs, leg irons, those kind of things, to control the situation as with what Camp Hill had on site. So we made the decision to call the other institutions that had the what was called the RERP equipment, the radiological emergency response equipment for the Berwick power plant, which is close to Graterford. If they had to evacuate Graterford, they'd use that equipment. Uh-huh. At these other sites. So Camp Hill fortunately had some of that equipment. We got Rockviews and Dallas's, and although Huntington had some of that, we decided not to take it from Huntington. They had had problems earlier in the week, and it was better off for them to keep it.
Can you describe for me, when you say equipment, what type of equipment are you talking about?
Mostly handcuffs and leg irons, hardware.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So that would be equipment they would have used to evacuate in the event of a nuclear meltdown or something.
Yeah, and for the receiving institutions to have that on hand for accepting inmates.
Okay. Wow. So a lot of people were talking about that there were communications issues. And back then, we didn't have the incident command system like we have now. So you had the DOC staff, you had PSP, you had the local police, local fire. How on earth was everybody communicating with each other? Or was it, like you said, more so of an organized chaos situation?
Yeah, it was just the communication was real difficult. We were even having trouble communicating with the rear gate, the sally port.
Why? What was under,
they would call in with a message, and sometimes it would get passed on, sometimes it wouldn't. Sometimes they were waiting for a response, and it wasn't clear that they were waiting for a response. It just it was just systems break down when they're under stress, and this is certainly a classic case of that, especially when you're not trained for it, as, and you just don't we just didn't have the expertise then that we do now, hopefully.
Right. Talk to me about the intensity of the second night. Obviously, it was worse than the first night. And then talk about how it was able to spread really throughout the entire institution. And also, and this is like a three-part question, but, you know, I know that the control center was inside. Talk about, so the intensity, how it was able to spread, and how the control center was at risk.
From what I understand, there were a few inmates that were never really accounted for, and one of them, was able to release other inmates because of the damage to the locking mechanisms of the other cells,
mm-hmm.
the cables that controlled the locks, and was able to start getting inmates out. And once they got some out, they got a bunch out, and staff had to leave areas that they wish they could, didn't have to, but they had to get out of there just as soon as they could. And quickly, you know, like when I was headed to my office, the central office, and there were a lot of hostages in the administration building, in the inside building. They'd gotten through air conditioning units that were not secured, and they got into that building and were starting to run that building. And setting everything on fire, and it spread like quicker than anyone could ever have forecast. And then areas that had been protected the night before, so the modular areas, for instance, they got into those and they just torched them. Some of the inmates there, they grabbed their own property and headed to the yard as much as they could, just to try and save it. And of course, the property, it ended up getting trashed anyway. But the inmates, a lot of the inmates didn't want to be involved, but they had almost no recourse but to try and protect themselves, number one, try to find someplace safe. We had inmates in the middle of the night come out to us and try and give us some intelligence as to what was going on and what. It's just really chaotic to get verifiable information. Mm.
Go ahead.
One of the things we were doing too, they were bringing some of the hostages, or the people that were able to get out right away. Even though the place was on fire, they'd come out, their faces were covered with soot. You could see where the snot was running down their face, the white marks from that. And you're trying to ask them to give you information before they take them away in an ambulance, as to who else is where, that kind of stuff. It was just try to get any piece of information you can and see how it fits together.
And staff in the control center were trapped in very smoky conditions and eventually, I guess, made it up to the roof. Was a deputy superintendent, I mean, there were some high-ranking prison officials that were trapped above control. Is that true?
Yeah, and I'm not sure who all was up there and exactly when. And we were devising a plan to... a plan of attack to go and try and get those people out of there. And while we were getting that approved, they were able to get out of harm's way. And exactly how all that happened, I don't know.
Okay. A lot of...
But yeah, you're right. The RCE and Terry and people like that were in harm's way for quite a while.
Right, the people who... were needed to make some of the decisions and even some that were doing some negotiations with some of the inmates, from what I read. A lot of people that I talk to, a common theme or thing that they mention is the ninjas, who weren't ours. They were the state police's specialty team. Do you have any recollections or memories of the ninjas?
I don't have. That they were able to get in and get a lot of information. They were able to get a couple hostages out. And they were actually, they helped by getting some of the cooperating inmates that had some intelligence out to us to give us some information about. I don't have much firsthand knowledge of exactly what all they did.
Uh-huh. I did have somebody mention to me that they saw a situation where, I'm not sure whether it was the first or second night, there was an employee being held hostage. Was having some medical issues, maybe even a heart attack. He was released by the inmates to the ninja team on a stretcher. And as soon as the ninjas got him, they went a couple of feet, put the stretcher down, and the hostage got up and ran. This was the cameraman that was on top of our central office roof taking videos. He said he saw that. Do you know about that situation? Was that individual actually having a heart attack, or was that just a plan to get the individual out? Do you know?
No, I don't know that.
Okay. I wanted to see if I could corroborate that. Because the cameraman was like, wow, they faked that to get that guy out. And I don't know that that's really the case. It could have been a case of adrenaline. The guy was out, and he just got up and started running. So,
yeah.
Okay. All right, so tell me about the rest of the day, how it came to an end for the prison and for you, and what happened then?
Mm-hmm. Well, as time went on, in the middle of the night, I was out on the perimeter just hearing the damage they were doing inside the cell blocks. And I came back to the command post, and there was a state representative. I think he was a state representative. I don't think he was a state senator, but he could have been. He came into the downstairs of the administration building demanding to see somebody. Well, everybody looked at me. And so I went downstairs and I said, yes, sir, how can I help you? And he said, well, who are you first? I identified myself. He said, okay. He said, you have a lot of our local officers on duty here. You're leaving my district at risk. And about this time, I was getting a little bit short on patience. And I said, well, if you have a bigger law enforcement emergency than this, I'll absolutely release your officers. He looked at me and he said, no, that's not what I want. I don't want that. I said, well, what do you want? And he said, I just want assurances that as soon as possible you'll get them back to our jurisdiction. I said, oh, absolutely. And that's easy to promise because that's exactly what we would like to. And he thanked me and left. I couldn't believe it.
So explain how they were being used. Were they like the state police and DOC staff just surrounding the perimeter trying to just support the perimeter?
The one report I had, we had about 400 people on the perimeter. I don't know if it was that many or not because I didn't see the backside. The front side, they were certainly clustered close enough that would be an accurate figure. Funny things happened. Like we kept getting all these pizzas, and they would want to take them out to the people on the perimeter. And they'd all start going the same direction, and so the people in front have too much pizza, and the people in the back have nothing. Just those kind of things that you don't have plans for, how it should work, that it starts just not working the way you want it to.
Right.
The state police, along with some corrections and local police, were pretty much on the perimeter. There were some state policemen inside, and a lot of DOC people inside, again, these inmates that didn't want to be involved, had to be guarded. And some inmates, we got inmates out in the middle of the night, a couple of them that were injured and they had to go to the hospital. I understand that one inmate called us and said, hey, I don't know what to do. I'm here at the hospital and there's no officer.
Oh, wow.
And so we told him, first go to the security of the hospital, identify yourself, and tell them that there's no security from the institution there, and we're going to get somebody over there as soon as we can.
Oh, my goodness. What a good guy to do
that. Well, you know, he's, I'm sure it's it would he was scared to death, too.
Right. So. He was probably hoping he could stay there and not come back, I'm telling you. Or, you know.
Yeah.
So
one thing, too, that I thought was interesting, but at the same, it was really important for him. The district attorney for the county stayed all night in the command post to observe and take notes. So when cases started getting prosecuted, he had more firsthand knowledge.
Wow. Yeah. I do have pictures of him sitting in the command post, so I'll definitely insert that into your transcript. And so when it finally was over, did you just go home?
Well, no. When we decided on the 6:30 or something like that in the morning to pinch the perimeter a little bit, and then once they did that and inmates started giving up, we started having them come out of the cell blocks and lay on the ground, and we started running out of room in some areas. But they really started giving up in mass. I got called to go over to see the secretary, and Chuck Zimmerman was there. And he looked at us, he said, Greg, Chuck, go to Waymart and get ready to take inmates tonight. So Chuck said, here, take the car, go to your house, get some more clothes and stuff, and then we're going to go to Waymart. And that's just what we did. We drove back up 81 and only had one flat tire.
Oh.
Anyway.
Wow. All right.
And I got to Waymart and got ready for inmates.
Okay, so we're going to talk to Chuck and in a little bit. So let me back up to the riots and kind of wrap that up. So looking back now, as the chief of security, do you remember seeing any trends, or did anybody have any information to know that this was coming?
Well, a couple of things. We knew we were having issues. We were just overcrowded with not much relief in sight. There been a track meet scheduled, an interinstitutional track meet scheduled, and it was going to be at Camp Hill. This is like a month and a half before the riot or something like that, I think. And we had some information that there was going to be problems there. And so we decided we were going to cancel it, but at the same time, the weather turned really rainy, so it gave us a very good reason to cancel that track meet. But we started getting indications that we had issues, but there wasn't like demands from inmates or a slew of grievances or anything like that. Heck, Camp Hill had just gone through accreditation, and there just wasn't any anything that would say Camp Hill's going to be a place that's going to have a lot of the place that's going to have issues. And of course, earlier in the week, Huntington had a significant problem. Rockview, earlier in the spring, it had a pretty good sized problem coming out of the dining hall. So there were things, but those are things that from time to time you expect to have a few issues like that. It wasn't anything that would really indicate that a riot was imminent and that you know, to take additional security precautions.
Wow. A lot of people had told me that morale was an issue. Very, very bad morale among the staff. Do you have any information about that? Like, why?
We've gotten, and it's actually more after the fact than before, but that there had been a lot of changes of direction, a lot of a lot of, okay, are we security? What are we supposed to do here? How are we supposed to do this? The big thing about the staff was they were overtaxed. I mean, once we started doing double selling, we got real good at it. Once we started finding basements to put inmates, we got too good at it. And so, you know, staff was a little bit concerned about that, and also just a little bit burnt out because you're taking that same amount of treatment staff and trying to do more, trying to get custody staff and get newer staff and trying to get them to perform at a high level in a changing environment. That's difficult to do. It was pretty clear that we weren't going to get a lot of help from the state legislature in the form of a lot of money, new prisons, that kind of stuff, right at that time. The staff at Central Office was ready. I mean, we'd been out to the to Boulder for training, and we knew how to design, build, and staff prisons. Just we didn't have anything on the drawing board.
Wow. So tell me, from a security standpoint and operational standpoint, how did the riots change not only SCI Camp Hill but the department?
Well, at Camp Hill, of course, the physical plant had to be all rethought and redone. And that took, you know, a lot of time and money to get that done. The other, and beyond that, a couple of things they decided. Number one, we have to go to unit management to have a whole different system to manage our prisons and our housing units.
Can you explain to me how it was at the time of the riot and what unit management is and why that was a good decision to go that way?
Prior to the riot, a lot of the housing unit decisions fell on sergeants and lieutenants, and mostly sergeants, but with security staff. Very little input from treatment staff. The treatment staff were in offices that were remote from the housing unit. With unit management, they have a manager in charge of the unit, both security and the counseling staff, and the counseling staff right on the unit, trying to keep problems at the lower level and get them resolved there, giving the unit manager the ability to
are you there? I lost you. Are you there?
It's fine.
I lost you. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, I lost you. So you were talking about how unit management allows the team essentially to make the decisions.
Yes.
And how was unit management accepted?
That was a difficult sell. You know, it probably wasn't the ideal conditions to implement it, but it certainly, over time, it was, like we did it at Waymart, I think it was accepted really well there. Number one, the staff that we got from Farview was used to that kind of a system.
Okay.
And number two, it's brand new, so you had some opportunities there that places that would have been in existence a long time didn't have. Even though our physical plant was a little bit goofy, it still enabled us to do it pretty easily. And one of the units was a drug and alcohol treatment unit, and it just lended itself very easily for that unit management system.
And of course, we still use the unit management concept today.
Mm-hmm.
What other changes or improvements came out of that? Was the first thing that you wanted to mention was unit management? What were some of the other things?
The prototypical institution design build. The way they financed them, the way they had it built, and the way they designed how that all happened a lot faster than the traditional process would have. So that gave us physical plants that we just didn't have, that we needed very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the response to emergencies, the training, the dedicated staff, the integration much closer with the community resources, and then the really training our own staff to so that we didn't have to rely on the state police if we had an emergency for hostage negotiations and rescue and going for to start from emergency teams, and the training level and equipment levels just a big step beyond wherever we were before.
Right. Talk about some of the other changes, such as interior fencing, tool control, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. A lot of security barriers so institutions could be sectioned off. Were put in place. The tool control, we were following ACA guidelines for tool control, we were able to improve on that shadow boarding and taking it from the maintenance department, where it always seemed to be where you looked at tool control, down to the housing unit itself, then mops and buckets and those kind of things. Making sure they were all accountable, that you didn't have a surplus of those and that kind of stuff.
And certain tools actually had to be outside of the perimeter from that point on. And when people talk about tools, they're talking inside Camp Hill at the time were acetylene torches and chainsaws and sledgehammers.
Excuse me. Yeah, they changed how tools were classified. And so some red tag tools or whatever you wanted to call them were then had to be secured, some secured outside the perimeter. It just was a much more organized system. One of the other things that's happened more in more recent years is all the cameras, all the video cameras, and the ability to see who's at a gate, to remotely control that gate, those kind of things. It really improves security also.
And do you think, because I mentioned Secretary Beard and I were talking about cameras as well and how cameras just were put up everywhere. How are cameras a deterrent to inmates acting out? Do you think they know, hey, there's a camera here, so I better not do this in some cases?
In a lot of cases, yeah, they do. They're they're aware of them because they have to come up to the same doors also. They know there's a lot of eyes on them that wouldn't have been there before.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also, many of them, and I know word gets around quickly that, you know, so-and-so did this in the visiting room, they caught on camera, and he's in a hole.
Right, or we'll use the footage from the video camera if it's a criminal activity, and we'll send that to the prosecutors, and they can use that against them.
Yes, yes. So sometimes they're probably more aware of it than the staff is. You know, we get used to them. The inmates are they study their surroundings probably more than we ever give credit for, and respond to them also. So they know the cameras are there and that they're an important part of the security of the institution.
Another thing back to the riot was after the first night, Superintendent Freeman went out to just assure the media that everything was settled down. And was there supposed to be the next day, was he supposed to meet with inmates? Do you recall that? Did that happen? And was there something that Freeman said the night of the afternoon of the 26th that made them mad that started the whole thing again? Do you recall any of that?
The way I recall is that there were a lot of delays and demands on time that he hadn't expected. Because of that, that did alter what he had intended to do, and I'd heard that, but I, you know, exactly as you mentioned it, but I'm not sure. I can't verify that.
Okay, and I know from a media relations standpoint, when we're in the middle of something, we're always very cognizant of the information that we provide, knowing that the inmates in an institution, even though the institution might be under severe rioting, they still have access to TVs. And radios, and they can hear what's going on. And I think during a couple of the media broadcasts that they were showing on the news diagrams of the institution and even maybe kind of pinpointing how they heard that the state police were coming into the institution. So can you talk a little bit about that, like why it's important that you can't always reveal your information?
That was one of the things that I don't know that we were prepared for the CNN type of coverage that this brought, the satellites and all that kind of stuff. And the media reports a lot of stuff. Not all of it's factual. They had one time there was a person that was tired, and there was a cot there by an ambulance, and they just laid down in it to rest. And the news media right away said, oh, here's a body. It's covered over. Somebody died in there.
Oh.
And there was, but the guy was just taking a break.
Right. I did hear somebody else mention that. So nobody died?
To my knowledge, no. I understand one inmate was shot.
Okay.
My information was that it wasn't a fatality, but I don't know. Rumors tell you there was a big a body count, but I've never heard that anyone actually died from Camp Hill.
Right. I'm going to jump back to the different changes that have been made since the riot. Do you have any information like on personal alarms? Staff, I guess they got better radios and better ways to communicate, but then also better ways to inform staff that they're in trouble.
The personal body alarms grew from that. Now that was technology that we'd already been looking at, and frankly, it just didn't work really too well. But they continue to, and now it's state of the art stuff is really what you expect. The price has come down a lot. Number one, number two, the way it's transmitted, you don't have dead spots and things like that that you did before.
Mm-hmm.
Even the telephone system.
And tell me about how, what was the system like? What was Camp Hill like with its keys, officer keys, at the time of the riot? And then how was that improved?
I don't know a tremendous amount about it since then, but I know before that, lots of big, heavy keys that you had to carry around, and keys to areas that you would not want inmates to get to, you had the keys for.
And if they got your keys, they could get into the same areas like throughout the institution. So that's how they were able to get into the cell blocks and let out the inmates, right?
the other inmates, yeah. And they've zoned keys. They've zoned the institution and only use keys for the area that you're in, and those kind of things. When you look at it, it's almost common sense, but we couldn't see that beforehand for some reason. We did do it as we brought on new spaces, but we sure didn't do it at Camp Hill. And Camp Hill wasn't alone. All the other old institutions sort of had issues too.
And knowing that, then, as a result of the riot and immediately thereafter, was there a notification from central office to especially those older facilities directing them to change their keys?
Especially the master keys, everything got to be restricted very quickly. A lot of times, too, staff would draw keys that for areas they just didn't need.
Oh.
We couldn't, well, say a maintenance person, they'd draw keys in the morning, it would get them just about anywhere in the institution. That ended up being, getting changed.
Wow.
So there were a lot of changes, key changes like that, a lot of really good, smart people worked on and made big improvements on it.
Tell me about how the stress of the situation impacted you. Now, I know your story kind of continues into Waymart, but how on earth did you deal with the stress? And how did your family deal with the stress? I mean, they dropped you off and went home. How did the stress impact you and your family?
I already knew that we're moving to Waymart, and so that was sort of, we were looking forward to that, and probably we were looking at waiting until the first of the year to get moved. Well, everything got compressed, and they were up by Thanksgiving, which was about 3 weeks after the riot or so. But the stress, I think what happens is you have when we went to Waymart, we had like missions that we had to get accomplished. A lot of them had to do with sorting out personnel and figuring out how we were going to everything, how we were going to interact with the inmates and keep them separate from the Farview patients, and then start absorbing functions from Farview did that we were going to do, and it's the whole transition. It all got compressed. I didn't have much chance to think about it, and think about what we were going through
It sounds like you might have been running on
for a couple
adrenaline.
months.
Running on adrenaline.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, so I've been up since 6 o'clock that morning, on the second day. 6 o'clock the next morning, 24 hours later, that we were told to go to Waymart, and Chuck and I drove to Waymart. We started getting staff in, and it was clear we weren't going to get inmates that night. I was up already over 36 hours, and then Chuck and we went into the next day getting ready to get these inmates, and all of a sudden Chuck and I looked at each other and said, one of us better go get some sleep so that once the inmates get here, somebody's able to be fresh enough to run this institution. And Chuck said, okay, go get some sleep.
Wow.
And, so I went and I found a bed in a deserted area at Farview and slept there that night.
Oh, my. Now, tell me about debriefing and what it was like then. Were you ever debriefed? And what it's like in more current times.
Yeah, I was never debriefed. I very much would have been better off if I had talked to John Ream or Dr. Belford or somebody for a while, I think. But never really was debriefed. And then things started, as time went on, you're trying to focus on what you're doing at Waymart, but also then what's happening at Camp Hill and staff getting replaced and all. It just continues to keep that front of mind as to what's really going on and how, frankly, we weren't sure we were done having rocks.
Okay. Why do you say that?
The biggest fear. We're not sure if that was the last one.
Because there's a possibility that these things are contagious, and based upon the fact that you knew that Rockview and Huntington had some issues as well? Is that what made you think that?
And Dallas is a big institution and had had some. Yeah, and then what do you do with the 2,500 inmates? And even where we were at Waymart, we got a couple hundred inmates, and so we're trying to determine whether or not they were part of the problem at Camp Hill.
Mm. Because accountability of the inmates was different then, right? Like, nobody was really sure who was who at some point, I think.
We got records for these guys that they were still smoking. And we're trying to figure out, make sure that this guy is really who he is, and is his time correct, and is... how are we going to do this and try to just make sure we knew who was who, and do we have the records for them all? And and we were physical plant wise, we had one area that was secure. It was pretty good cell block area, and about three other rooms that we could lock people up. But other than that, we were out of luck. These inmates did not get to the gym or to the yard until March.
Which inmates? Where are you talking about?
The ones that we got from
at Waymart
Camp Hill.
Okay.
At Waymart, we didn't. They did not get out of the dining hall and back, and a little bit of recreation, but they didn't really get outside until March. And the only reason they got out then was we had one of our perimeter patrol guys ran over a propane tank exhaust valve, and we had to evacuate because of an emergency.
Wow. So I have a couple questions based on what you just said, and the first one was about the records at Camp Hill. You said it was smoking, like literally?
You could see where they had been burned. Okay. and they had that smell of burnt paper.
And another one of the major changes was moving records offices and facilities outside of the perimeter. So, because apparently that would help you keep better account of your inmates if they are burning the inside of the facility.
Yeah.
Another question I had was from a systemic standpoint, when the riot was happening, did Central Office send out notification to and direction to the other institutions telling them to lock down? Did we have a lockdown, or was it just kind of watch your inmates type of thing?
Now, the way I recall, it was more just watch your inmates, especially at first. The first day sort of took everybody by surprise. The second day, I don't even know that there was direction more than just watch your inmates and keep us informed. We did start asking for a report every day as to what's going on with your institution. institution.
And didn't the other institutions, state prisons at the time, also send staff to Camp Hill?
Yes. As soon as their emergency teams came down from most places, and then we sort of rotated some other staff around and. Go for, I think it was a solid week or something like that.
So the whole system was definitely feeling it and was definitely impacted, because if they were sending their CERT teams down, they weren't necessarily at full staff either.
Well, and then we start, even at Waymart, we got staff from basically Dallas and Retreat mostly. There's no doubt about it, though. The whole department and frankly the whole state police were heavily impacted by Camp Hill.
Right. And in the end, almost the entire prison was destroyed.
Yeah. The rebuild was pretty amazing to watch.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I wasn't as involved with it, but they did a lot of modular construction, and there was very few housing units that were usable. The main dining room, I believe, was still in pretty good shape, but the modular units were just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the maintenance shops were a mess, and number one, you have to get DGS involved and get a lot of planning done. The initial cost was about a $50 million bill, I think. I don't know what it ended up being totally, but
wow,
it's a big dollar amount.
And that prison now is nothing at all what it was like back then.
It sure isn't. I mean, it's a modern facility now.
Right. Back to how it affected you, did you ever have, I know you were busy and you didn't have much sleep, but when you did sleep, did you have nightmares?
Not really. Not at the time. Every now and then I'll get a flashback of standing out on the walkway and looking in at it burning. One of the HR people from Central Office told me that I haven't seen anything like this since Vietnam.
Wow.
So
what are some of the things
that haunted me a little bit is when I was running up the road, hearing the cries.
Hearing the cries of whom?
Superintendent Friedman's family.
Oh. Because his house was situated right there.
Right there, yeah.
Wow. What advice would you give to current day correction staff in the event that they're involved in some sort of incident, whether it be an isolated incident? I know they hate that term, but a contained incident to a full-on all-out riot. What advice would you give to employees?
Well, the first thing is know your training, take it seriously, and follow your plan. They've been well thought out. They've had the test of time now. Follow that plan so that the doors close when they're supposed to, that the you get to the area you're supposed to. You report. Use your the way there must ever work.
I'm losing you.
Plan.
Oh, there you go. Are you there? I lost you. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, so. So follow policy, know your evacuation routes. So if you can get out, get out.
Yeah.
What happens if you can't get out?
you know, where are you supposed to shelter? Make sure they know who you are and where you're at. Those kind of things. And when you get a chance to get out, take it.
And also observe everything, right? Because when they get you out, and when you get out, DOC, PSP, they're going to be coming at you wanting as much information from you as possible to help resolve the situation, correct?
Yes, resolve the situation and then respond to everything that happens there afterwards.
And then they'll get you to your medical treatment.
Yeah.
Unless it's really life-threatening, they'll probably take care of that first, obviously. But, wow, what a situation. And so,
yeah.
Since the riot and while you were still with the DOC, have you experienced anything, certainly not at the same level, but any other major situations that you were able to better handle because of the riot?
Well, the rest of my career in the department, yeah, that was good training to go to Pittsburgh, that's for sure. lots of emergencies there that we were able to handle and handle better because of not just my experience at Camp Hill, but the others also, other staff also. And Green, when you walked around SCI Green, you absolutely felt secure. Here's a new facility. It's built the way a maximum a level 4 institution should be. It just had the physical plant to handle issues much more so than any place else I ever worked.
Well, and I think that was probably a problem. The problem with Camp Hill was, you know, it was built in the 1940s for really juvenile offenders.
Yeah.
And the construction was different. The lines of sight were different. Obviously, those things improve over the decades as well. The inmates in Camp Hill, like you said, the locking mechanism just was flawed, and they knew how to get out. But also the cinder blocks that were used, go ahead.
Yeah, they busted right from one cell to another, and
and just kept going until they were able to free themselves.
So
we definitely learned a lot, and I did watch the new housing units be built at Camp Hill, and they're very impressive individual cell modular cells that are pure concrete and they're not cinder blocks anymore. So definitely very different and much improved. So I think we'll wrap this up. Is there, when you think about the riots, are there any special stories or recollections besides everything that you just talked about that you remember most? Any odd stories or interesting things that happen that you think, wow?
I guess I go back to that first night, and we're inside there walking around, and just turning that one corner and walking up that one main roadway, mm-hmm. and it's just lined with DOC and